Time Gab. He's Stuart Robson. No, Jules, he's still on holiday, but he'll be back shortly, never fear. Gray, ugly, depressing. No, that's not Robbo.
Oh, that's
that
not,
would
no,
be Mark Ogden. It's the weather, because I think God is finally mourning for the fact that Italy won't be going to the World Cup.
At long last, they're mourning.
Exactly, but we have a full show for you today. So much going on. Barcelona and Sevilla, Chelsea losing, United drawing, City and Liverpool winning, Bayern controversy, 12 men, Dortmund sticking it up. But I think there's one evident place to start here with the help of Don Hutchinson, and it's Juventus against Inter. Don, I want to start with you because Juve have had this incredible unbeaten streak in Serie A where many times they haven't played well, but they've won. Here, I thought they played well. I thought they attacked. They went for it. They should have had more out of the game. They've got some grievances as well. And yet, they lose. Shoes on the other foot here.
You can't fault a single player, Gab, Stuart. It was one of them games where every player that stepped onto that pitch last night put in a brilliant performance. Juve, I thought, were very unlucky that they never come away with anything from the game, because that's the best I've seen them. The intensity was there. They were closing down. They were winning the 50-50s. They were getting balls into Dybala's feet. Morata looked very sharp. Vlahovic had chances. It was just a brilliant game of football. It was wild. But from Juve's point of view, to come away with zero feels a little bit harsh on them. But some performance, some away performance from Inter.
It finished 1-0 to Inter. Mm. And the only goal came towards the end of the first half. Quick recap for it. Alexandro and Morata coming together with Dumfries. I thought it was a soft penalty. Went to VAR. VAR gives the penalty. Çalhanoğlu from the spot. He has his penalty saved. Then he runs. He puts in the rebound. But then somehow that goal gets disallowed. And there's confusion. It's not clear. And then VAR says, no, take the penalty again, because Matthijs de Ligt was in the box.
Which
he takes it again. He buries it in the box. Now, by the law, that whole procedure is correct. It seemed a bit weird to me, but apparently the guy being in the box trumps anything that happens afterwards, and it's not like you can give advantage on it. That's something I discovered last night. I am not a referee. But I want to ask about the penalty, because that is the big sticking point. Adrian Rabiot, very harsh about it. We found out later the penalty was given because VAR spotted essentially a stamp on Dumfries' foot, his foot coming down on top of Dumfries' foot. Don, it still felt soft to me, but apparently that's the IFAB directive?
Yeah, it was a nightmare for myself and Adam Summerton commentating on the game, because there was so much going on. And you're right, when Morata, and you used the word stamp, it wasn't a sort of stamp. He was trying to get his body across, but his foot then caught the laces of Denzel Dumfries, and he then caught him. And then there was so much going on, because it took 5 or 6 minutes for the referee and the VAR team to try and spot, and we only had one or two angles and replays of it. And my initial thought, like you, Gab, I thought it looked soft, and it looked really soft. And only when you see more pictures and more evidence, then I think it leans more towards being a penalty. But it was the whole confusion what happened after that. So that you're right in saying, in order what happened, but initially when Szczesny made the save, the referee then blew from a foul as the ball went over the back of the line and into the net. The referee blew from a foul from Çalhanoğlu, and you're thinking, I don't see a foul there from Çalhanoğlu. I don't see a foul whatsoever. Then the VAR guys give the referee more information that De Ligt was inside the box and he was the player that then put the block on, which was 100% correct. So it was the whole procedure that took time and took emotion, which was incredible. And Max Allegri, the pictures of Max Allegri taking his jacket off and throwing
brilliant.
It was incredible.
That was brilliant. Robbo, I just want to get you on this, because anybody who's played football at any level knows that sometimes your foot will come down and you'll step on somebody else's foot. This directive, this kind of this blanket directive that, look, whether it's violent or not, you are impeding the other person when you do that, so it's a foul. Does that feel right to you?
Not really, because, as Don just said, if it's a stamp and a stamp that's done on purpose, then it should be a foul, and it should probably be a yellow card. It should be a penalty. But when it's an accident, when it's just your stride taking you onto the other person's foot, that's not always a foul. It can't always be a foul.
But you can't use the benchmark, is it an accident or not, because when you go for an honest tackle, you're presumably not trying to foul the other person, and yet it's still a foul, right? If you impede his progress. That's what makes it difficult.
But when two players are, as you run and you're lifting your foot up and putting it back down again, there'll always be sometimes where you're vying for the same spot on the grass. I think it was a very, very soft penalty.
I agree. It didn't feel right to me, Don. And you know, and I think this is one of those things. I'm pro VAR, but this is one of those things that in a pre VAR world, I don't think that ever gets called. No. Also, because the referee's not necessarily looking for that. He's looking for contact further up. It's easy to be unsighted when it's down on the ground. I want to ask you where this leads to the title race. Milan playing this evening, of course, they're top of the table, level with Napoli on 66 points. Inter 3 points back. They have the game in hand. Did Inter look like potential champions to you, or is it fair to say that their bad run of form continues despite the 3 points?
No, they look like champions to me. I mean, I know their form was pretty bad. I was looking at the numbers before the game, guys, and it was unbeaten in seven, scoring 22 goals at the start of the season. And their last seven, only one win, two clean sheets. Apart from the five against Salernitana, they'd not been scoring goals. They were bang out of form. Arrigo Sacchi, the great Arrigo Sacchi, was calling for Inzaghi to change to a back three, to go to a back four. He's the oracle on tactics, not me. And then they went away. Then they went away last night. And it was that performance that Stu will understand when you're away from home in the lion's den and you've got a graft and you've got a fight and you've got to survive the first 20 minutes, half an hour. And Inter only just done that. But they showed great willingness and great spirit to stay in the game. And then they got the penalty just on half time. Second half, they played so much better. There was a little bit more freedom about them. The three guys in midfield, I thought, kept the ball really, really well. One of Barella's best games for quite a while. Cianlolu got his goal. And they mixed it up quite well. They knew when to go long. They knew when to play short into midfield. So as away performances go, in a difficult environment, in a hostile environment, top-class performance from Inter.
I take on board what Don says. I'm always about, all right, performance, who's playing well, and so ever. But equally, I can't shake the fact here, and I'd love to hear from both of you on this one. Obviously, Don, you were watching the game very closely. Allegri went out there to attack. I think he really caught Inter off guard. They got back into it, and they had legit chances afterward. The Correa chance where he was all off balance when he finished and whatever. So you can say, well, they could have added, Inter could have scored more. But I would say, yeah, but that's after they took the lead, after they got outplayed in the first half. Sometimes teams just have this these spells where
You have to have that bit of luck, and Don's absolutely right. They defended well throughout the game. They showed a lot of spirit. They kept the ball better in the second half. They defended for their lives when the balls came into the box. But you've got to remember, Vlahovic, with that brilliant turn just outside the box, should have scored. Chiellini hit the bar early on in the game from a set play. And they were caught, I think, a little bit off guard.
And he hit the woodwork another time, too.
Zakaria, when he came on. And I think they were caught a bit off guard, as you were saying, because Morata was playing on the left-hand side, coming in from that left-hand side. Sandro was getting high and wide on the left-hand side. Dybala playing in the hole behind the main centre-forward. So it was a very attacking lineup that Juventus put out. And for much of that first half, they dominated the game, but didn't take their chances. And Inter had that bit of luck. And you need that bit of luck when you are playing away from home against the top sides. And Juventus, over the last few weeks, have been a top side. But it might just be the springboard for Inter to go on and win the title.
Don, I want to ask you about this, about Allegri's lineup and his setup, because I've long been a proponent that you can't play defend and counter and win. It's very, very difficult to go and do that. You have to take the opposition. And it's been one of my criticisms, perhaps, of Allegri. But did we see that Juve can actually do that? That you can actually play this 4-2-3-1? It can get into your DNA at home. You can go and just batter the opposition and want the ball and keep the ball and really engage them high up the pitch? Or
I thought they were great. I thought they were great.
Why don't they do this more often?
I know. Well, where I've watched Juve over the past season or so, and I keep seeing Max Allegri sometimes revert to a 4-4-2. And that's fine. Tactics are tactics. As I said before, I'm not a guru on tactics. But when I see individual players playing in that system, i.e. Rabiot playing as a left-sided player, a left winger, if you like, because he's in a 4-4-2, I'm thinking, no, that's not his position. He played centrally last night, and I thought he had one of his best games. I thought he was outstanding. So that's the system. Or that's the system to match that personnel. Dybala, as Stu said, was in the hole. Morata's so much better now Vlahovic is in the team, because the focus is now on or not on Morata playing as a number nine, but he's back to play, he can face the play, he can try his tricks, and he works a lot harder rather than being the focal point. So as performances go, he must be scratching his head, Allegri, thinking, we couldn't have done much more last night. As you said, the chances, they got their luck. I mean, the big turning points in the game was obviously the penalty, the discussion about maybe a Bastoni foul in the second half. Juve could have had a penalty. Should Lautaro Martinez actually been pitch inside half an hour?
We're going to get it. We're going to get to Lautaro in a minute.
Yeah, his games goes, Gab. It was absolutely wild.
I think if you're a Juve fan, if I were a Juve fan, which I'm not, but I would say,
Max, you're anything but a Juve fan, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I would say, Max, stick with this.
Yeah, yeah.
Stick with some version. I know Dybala's leaving or whatever, but stick with this attitude. And maybe, you know, if Morata's not there, maybe you play Moise Kean, maybe you play Bernardeschi on the other side. You've got alternatives. But this has to be the framework, at least in terms of attitude, of being proactive, of taking the game to the opposition. This whole fino alla fine, like, stuff, like, till the end, you know, it's fine. Those days are gone. They're not coming back. You need to have players who want to play the ball and who go and engage in attack. And you show that you can do it.
To win the title, to win the Champions League, to win whatever tournament you're in, you have to be a proactive side. You have to have possibly more of the ball in the top third of the field. You have to go and win the ball high up the field. You have to be the dominant side. That's what Juventus were under Antonio Conte those first 3 years. That's what they were when Max Allegri first took over. I'm not sure why he's changed in this second situation.
I'd argue he changed probably towards the end of his first stint. Then they tried to change it with Sarri and Pirlo, and for many reasons it didn't work. Also because I think the players just weren't suited to it, and they had Cristiano, who required a certain way of playing. But man, I actually, if I'm Juve, I'm disappointed for the result, but I look around and I see that Atalanta lost.
Good performance.
And I'm thinking to myself,
we played well.
You know what? We played well. I feel more confident about finishing top four, not less confident, despite
I fully agree with you, Gab.
Let's get to the Lautaro incident, because I thought, as a group, Inter strikers were poor, whether it's Dzeko, whether it's Correa, who missed that big chance, or whether it's Lautaro. Don, you got a booking in the first minute for essentially whacking Locatelli in the face. And Locatelli later had to come off. And I thought that, you know, that's another blow for Juve, by the way. And then the second one, that clash with Chiellini, in real time, it looked to me like maybe the referee wasn't 100% sure who fouled who and whatever. But when you watch it again, it's not good. That was a second yellow, right?
Oh, definitely. And that was actually the third one. There's a little sort of misdemeanor in between them where it was a little push. Well, that was by the by. That was just a sort of secondary foul. That sort of happens. But the foul on Locatelli in the first minute when he cut the top of his eye, definite yellow card, not a red. Then there was a 50-50 in and around the halfway line between himself and Chiellini. And Chiellini got there first. And then he didn't just lose out in the 50-50 then, Lautaro Martinez. He actually left his left foot in and caught Chiellini. And as Chiellini does, and as any experienced professional would do, he rolled around. He had grimaces on his face, like he snapped his leg in half. And he was making sure the whole world, including the referee, knew that Lautaro Martinez caught him. And I said in comms, I went, if he survives this and doesn't get a red card, a second yellow, he's a very, very lucky man. He was pumped up for the game. But that's where Inter got their look. He should have been sent off.
Don, you said any experienced professional would roll around and grimace and so on. Now, I can't say I remember Robbo as an experienced professional, because it was slightly before my time, and your career also ended a little early.
He's played the youth card, Robbo.
But I remember you as an experienced, as an old professional. I don't remember you rolling around on the ground for hours over and over again. Like, is it something you'd done more of?
No, but you would, Gab. You would. I guarantee you, Stu will back me up.
Robbo's shaking his head.
We played at a different time, Don. Slightly different time,
Don. To get someone sent off in a game for a legitimate second yellow card, I do not blame Chiellini one bit.
So did you do that, Don? Because I'm going to ask Robbo the same question.
Definitely. 100% to get someone sent off, yeah.
But again, I played at a different era when there weren't many sending offs. You had to do something really bad to get somebody sent off. So it was almost a badge of honour that if you got fouled, you'd get up and sort of, that didn't hurt. I mean,
so there was no point doing it.
There was no point doing it because you weren't going to get anybody sent off.
It is true. It's one of those weird, I remember like being a kid and like, I remember like, wasn't it like the first player sent off in the FA Cup final was like
Kevin Moran in 1980, whatever it was.
That was after like they played 100 FA Cup finals and nobody got sent off.
I mean,
that's pretty extraordinary, right?
The famous Vinnie Jones would come in and kick you and stamp on you. And I always used to say, is that the best you can do? Is that the best you can do? Which used to wind him up even more. So you didn't show you were injured in those days because it's all changed because you didn't get anybody sent off.
Right.
Sure.
But I understand what Don's saying. If you think you can get somebody sent off, that's why the players do it now, because they know they're going to throw it to VAR and you might well have made a bad challenge.
Don, final point here on Juve, sorry, on Inter here, because you talked about how well the midfield worked. I saw Barella really running himself into the ground with so much energy. Brozovic at the beginning was shielded by Dybala, struggled a little bit. Later, it kind of opened up a little. Yep. You know, Çalhanoğlu again with the penalty. They really carried Inter at this stage, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. It was, as I said, because, or as we've said, Juve started the game so fast. So when you're away from home and you've got to dig in and you can't find any balls into Lautaro Martinez or Edin Dzeko, the midfield have to be brave. Defenders have to defend and put their body on the line. And Handanovic had to make one or two sort of long-distance saves. He looked a little bit nervy, I must say. But the midfield three, they knew when to dig in. They knew because of their experience, the clock, where they're at in the game, the points of the game. Then second half, once it got a little bit stretched, Brozovic used the ball so much better. But like I said, that's the throwback of these sort of older games and this monumental game for Inter. When you're away from home, they've dug in, they've ground out a performance. I said in the comms, it's 1-7. Well, 1-7, 1-7. You can bury that. You've just gone to Juve, and you've just dumped Juve at the title race.
So
and you're 3 points closer to Napoli, and you're 3 points closer to Milan. What a win!
From an entertainment perspective, I mean, I was on the show last time with Frank LaBeouf, and Frank LaBeouf said he thought it was a horrible game because there was rolling around on the ground, and there wasn't that much quality. I was thoroughly entertained throughout. Because I love it when teams are out there trying to win any means necessary. Maybe it wasn't always as pretty, like as
watching. But don't you think there's... I still get very frustrated. I'm not talking about Frank in particular. But there's an ignorance about Italian football. You know, people have this thing, oh, well, it's boring, it's this, it's too defensive. It's nothing of the sort these days. You see some great games in Serie A, teams that want to play on the front.
His complaint wasn't that it was defensive. It was more that... There was too much fouling. There was too much with the referee. Too many players getting booked. And
that's what happens in football.
And I thought it was intense. And I was it was a rough ride, but that was part of the drama, Don. Right?
Loved it. I loved the style of the game. I loved the passion of the game. I loved the quality of the game. The fans made that atmosphere unreal. I'm sure everyone sitting at home watching the game was sitting back and just watching the game unfold as we were. Hectic to commentate on. But as I said before, every single player that stepped out on the pitch, done their job and produced a fantastic game of football. Hard for the managers, by the way, because every time a player got a yellow card, Inzaghi would take one of his players off and get fresh legs, fearing to go down to 10. Allegri was the same. As soon as someone got booked for Juve, he'd take one off and put one on. So it was just a wild game to watch, but an entertaining. And I disagree with Frank completely. I thought it was loads of quality out there.
Yeah, I enjoy myself. Final point on this, great point you made about the atmosphere and the fans. And look, the theme of the ultras, their role in football and stuff like that often gets debated. Do they have too much influence and so on? What I thought was interesting about this game is Juve ultras obviously not there for reasons that we all know about. Inter ultras not making the trip, many of them, because they felt that they were unhappy with the way that the ticketing was done and surcharges and protest against Juve or whatever. And yet still, it was a cracking atmosphere. I think maybe that should give some people some food for thought. Don, thank you so much.
Cheers, guys.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Gab. Just go to Indeed.com/Gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. All right, enough Juve. Robbo, just when you thought Chelsea and Thomas Tuchel had things back under control again, what do they do a few days ahead of this, with all the turmoil off the pitch happening with Roman Abramovich and the sale, which we'll get to in a minute? What do? They play at home against Little Brentford, you know, the stadium by the bus stop, a few minutes away, and they lose 4-1 just a few days ahead of that huge clash against Real Madrid.
Yes, and Chelsea didn't start the game particularly well. It started with Mendy with a pass out from the back. He gives it away and Tony should score and lifts it over him. And from that moment on, you just felt Chelsea were on edge. They didn't defend particularly well. There's a couple of crosses that came into the box. They were loose all around the field. They didn't play with enough pace when they were going forward, enough invention when they were going forward. He started with Ziyech, who I really like, on the right-hand side. Timo Werner's still not the player, nowhere near the player he was when he was playing in Germany. And Havertz playing as the centre forward, you know, I know people like him as a centre forward. I still don't see him as an out-and-out centre forward. So I thought they struggled throughout the game. Yes, they got the opening goal through Rudiger, a magnificent shot. But overall, they were, although they had more possession, they had, I think, 71%, they didn't create any more chances than Brentford did. And Brentford probably deserved their victory.
Also, this formation with this back four just never looks...
No.
It doesn't look... I mean, the advantage of the back four... in Chelsea's view, and obviously this is forced because of Chilwell and James came on, but he's not fully fit. The advantage of the back four, I presume, is that you've got wingers who can put in crosses, right? You've got more width and so on, because your two fullbacks end up basically being center backs playing at fullback, right?
Yeah.
Although he did have Alonso playing, to be fair. But it looked like he didn't exploit it. And I wonder if some of that is also to do with what was happening in the middle of the park, where there was no Jorginho, but you had Ruben Loftus-Cheek, who's just a completely different type of player.
Well, I've seen Chelsea play with a back four in a couple of FA Cup games, and with Ziyech and Azpilicueta down the right-hand side, and they've usually worked quite well together. But Alonso was the player that was trying to get forward. Azpilicueta was trying to get forward as well to try and overlap and create the overload, and it left them at the centre half position, a little bit open at times. And Loftus-Cheek, I don't think, has got a great defensive understanding. Conte, I thought, would be the player to play in the holding role, but he was playing one side of Loftus-Cheek, and Loftus-Cheek was meant to be that holding player to go between his centre halves and provide that extra bit of cover. And he didn't do that particularly well. And the centre halves, for once, and I think Thiago Silva has been magnificent throughout the season, didn't play at his best. And Rudiger, likewise, didn't see the danger. And they were looking around at everybody else. Alonso wasn't quite back in position at times when crosses were coming into the box. So it was a disjointed display by Chelsea, and one that I didn't really see coming.
Thiago Silva's wife taking to social media and saying, like, lay off my husband. He's human. He's not a machine. which I thought was kind of sweet. And also, I don't know. I kind of feel like...
Does your wife defend you on Twitter and things like that?
No, never. But I do wonder, though, I mean, picking on Thiago Silva is a little bit, you know, the dude's 36, he's given everything. You know what he can do, and you know what his limits are. But I wanted to ask you, defensively, I think there were a whole bunch of screw-ups in that game. And the Christian Eriksen goal in particular, we're talking about it off air, right? So it's a counterattack. The ball goes to, I think it was Mbeumo on the left side. And Christian Eriksen is running up the pitch. Christian Eriksen, heart or no heart, he's a middle distance runner.
He
covers a lot of ground slowly. Right? He never was fast. It's difficult. Can you just run us through a little bit about how it's possible that Christian Eriksen can outrun everybody and be completely unmarked the area?
When he took up the position, because it was I think it might have been a set play for Chelsea. And when it was cleared, as always, N'Golo Kanté was the player on the halfway line. And Alonso was on the right-hand side. I think he lost out to Mbeumo. And Mbeumo's quick. So he started running. But Eriksen was almost by his side. And Eriksen all started running straight and then veered off to the right hand side. So the players on the left hand side, Alonso wasn't there. He'd have been the player recovering normally on the left hand side. So there was nobody coming back on that side. Conte had a decision coming towards the end of Mbeumo's run. Do I go to Mbeumo and stop him shooting, or do I cut off the pass to Eriksen? And he tried to do both, and he almost did it perfectly. He tried to hold up the play. He got in line with the pass. The pass went between his legs. Mbeumo got a bit lucky, but it was the right run from Eriksen. Thiago Silva, I think, was one of the players trying to get back. There was Alonso didn't get back.
You don't want to show Eriksen love for his first Premier League goal.
Oh, I do. The movement was excellent because he went towards the ball, then realised, no, that wasn't where the space was, and went the other way. And it was a good finish as well.
Hey, Robbo. So just to give a little update on the sale of Chelsea, this never-ending thing filled with questions.
You're buying it.
No, it's not going to be me.
Okay.
So April 11th is a deadline for the next set of bids. But, I mean, deadline, schmedline, right? Most people say there's four left in there. What's interesting is this isn't something where one person comes and buys it. There's all groups of billionaires banding together, which I think is really interesting from a governance perspective in terms of what happens next. But the one that we're told in some ways is in the driving seat is the Ricketts family.
Right.
Why they're in the driving seat, I presume maybe they made the highest bid. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff that we don't know here. But, and then, by the way, it's not just the Ricketts family. They've teamed up with others, of course. But there's been a big backlash, which we've talked about, against sort of the patriarch for comments he's made in the past about Muslims. There's the, where he said, Muslims are my enemy. The him, who's going to be directly involved, but it has definitely affected things. And Chelsea Supporters Trust, you know, releasing a statement saying that they'd polled their supporters. 77% have a negative opinion of the Ricketts family. That's tough to overcome. And so they've kind of been on a PR offensive. And one of the things they've said is they've pledged never to join a Super League. I'm assuming, whatever your thoughts are on this, but if the people who owned your club made a pledge like that, would your instinct be to believe them?
Not really, no. No, but I'm quite cynical. So, no, I wouldn't say I would believe them. They're buying the club because they want to make money, and lots of people think that the best way to make money as a super club is to go into a super European league. I really can't answer that question. But as the supporters, they obviously aren't happy with them at the moment. And if somebody takes over that's never going to be popular, it doesn't work, does it? As we've seen with the Glazers at times.
Yeah, I mean, I think to some degree you can win people over.
It takes a long time.
But I think a lot of times when we see the sale of a club, it's often an unpopular owner, say Mike Ashley.
Yeah.
You know, being replaced by somebody new who you might have reservations about or whatever. And so in some ways it makes it easier. Here, you're replacing somebody who, leaving the political side of things aside, was extremely popular with Chelsea fans before the way they invested
the club. Fate of Chelsea.
Exactly. So it is a tough act to follow, and I think that's part of what makes the Ricketts bid what makes him a bit uneasy. What I find fascinating though is that you have supporters of Real Madrid and Juventus, and among others, saying like, "Oh, you're all idiots. We need a Super League for Europe to survive. Otherwise, we'll be dominated by petrodollar clubs and blah, blah, blah," right? And, you know, and they're angry that there is no Super League. And here we have somebody coming in, buying a club that's, or bidding for a club that, you know, in some ways, in the context of football, is nouveau riche, right?
Yeah, of course it is.
Telling the fans, making it kind of a central platform, I will never join a Super League.
Unless another 10 join it and we're left out.
I mean, look, you either believe it or not, but like VR-wise, that's the point he's pushing. But yes, of course, if every other big club goes and joins a Super League and he's under pressure, and also, you know, Ricketts may be the lead investor, but there are other groups in there. Some of them are wealthy individuals. Some of them are private equity types who say, hey, I'm a private equity fund. It's not my money. It's my investors' money. I got to look out for my investors. If my investors think we want a return, Super League is it.
Yep.
I have a fiduciary duty to do what they tell me to do. You know, because this is another point that I think people often miss out on, is the Glazers, it's their money. Or rather, as we know, it's the bank's money. Whatever, right? So they can answer for themselves. But others, when you are owned by a fund, you know, you've got fiduciary responsibilities.
You've got to look after their money.
Yeah, which I think is another point that's not always part of the conversation. I want to ask you about Brentford because obviously it's a tremendous story. We know what happened. Matthew Benham helping to kind of invest in the club, rebuild the club. They do things very differently. I'm fascinated, you know, in this game against Chelsea, they had less than 30% possession. And so much of their game seems to be about energy, second balls, and transition. I think together with a whole bunch of tactical awareness off the ball. I mean, I actually think they defend really, really well. And they're very smart about it. I mean, is that a patronizing thing to say? Or
no, I think because if you looked at them player for player, you wouldn't say Brentford have got top-class players. They've got some good players, but you wouldn't say any of their players are absolutely top-class players.
Well, I ask you this, right?
Yeah.
Eriksen aside.
Yeah. Well, I like the front
many,
two.
How many Brentford players do you think would start for teams not in the relegation zone in the Premier League?
Not very many.
So, in other words, not Norwich. Norwich, you would say most of them, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah.
Not
take
very
Norwich
many.
And Burnley.
I like the front two from what I saw last season. They've played well in certain games because sometimes they're isolated, the front two, and they do well at working together. They flick on balls for each other. They've got a bit of pace with Mbeumo running in behind. Tony's a good finisher and good with his back to goal and can hold up the play. But they're quite often isolated. So, those two do a good job. You know, they've got a decent left wing back in Rico Henry who can get forward and get crosses into the box. But overall, it's a team effort. It's the way the manager sets them up. It's the way they understand the game. And against Chelsea, it was set up for them. They've got three big centre-halves that can deal with balls into the box. And Chelsea don't have a big striker.
Oh, no, they don't. Oh, no, Romelu Lukaku only comes on 20 minutes from time and they're 3-1 down.
So they allow the ball to go wide. And Chelsea are then reluctant to play it into the box.
Can you explain that, the Lukaku not coming on? I mean, I don't...
Well, it was obvious.
I understand. When you're down at home, the clock is ticking. I mean...
But also, even when Rudiger scores the goal, Chelsea still weren't playing particularly well. Although they had 71% of the ball, they didn't create that many clear-cut opportunities. Brentford probably had the better opportunities. So they had to change the way the game was going. You know, you can have all that. You've got to, at some point, if a team wants to let you have space out wide, you've got to try and threaten them by playing balls into the box. And Chelsea don't do that enough at times.
Is he keeping him fresh at Real Madrid?
I don't think he'll play against Real Madrid, that's for sure.
Can you explain this thing with the second balls? Because I remember years ago, when Guardiola was having a rough patch and people are talking about, oh, well, your team's not good at tackling, you don't win second balls. And he's like, what is tackling? What is second balls? I don't remember. I mean, he was taken out of context, obviously. One of the reasons, many reasons I was given for Italy not being at the World Cup is also like, oh, we don't win enough second balls. Can you explain what a second ball is and why Brentford are so good at winning second balls?
Well, second balls, as a midfield, when I was playing in midfield, everything was about second balls. So when the goalkeeper kicked the ball on and you're up against another midfield player, the opposition's midfield player, and the centre-half and your centre-forward go up and head the ball or try and make contact with the ball, when it drops down, you've got to try and be first. That's a second ball. You've got to try and be... So if you get control of it, now you're in control of the game. You play your next pass and your team are on the front foot.
In other words, what they call often like dirty balls. When somebody... When a ball comes out and it's miscontrolled, it's miscontrolled or so on, and it suddenly becomes available to whoever gets there first.
I'll give you a great example of a game that was won by... And Inter actually played well on the day. A game that was won by a team that were better at winning the second balls because they were quicker and more alert. Liverpool against Inter in the first game at the San Siro. Every time the ball dropped in midfield, you thought that Liverpool players were going to get onto it because they were a little bit sharper, and that started the counter-attacks. Whereas Inter didn't have that pace in midfield or didn't have the awareness to go and win that second ball. Vidal was trying to, but he couldn't quite get there. So second balls are all about winning those dirty balls as you can.
So why are Brentford good at it? Like, how do you coach that? How do you teach that?
Because you put it into the players' minds. You know, you've got to win that second ball. You know, as the ball's travelling, you know, get to the second ball, follow up the play. You know, and
because it seems basic, right? You're out there on the pitch, you're trying your hardest. I mean, to a layman, you would think, well, there's no reason that everybody wouldn't be trying to do this.
Or So Chelsea's midfield, when the ball's being played up, they expect Thiago Silva to chest the ball down and come out with it. So they're making an angle to receive the ball rather than waiting for the knockdown.
Right. And if Thiago Silva's ball or control isn't perfect, there's a second ball to be won and the other Chelsea players aren't ready. Yeah. There you go. See? Fount of tactical and football knowledge. One of many reasons we have Stuart Robson.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
All right, enough Chelsea. How about some quick hits instead?
Let's do it, Gab.
A Pedri wonder goal, and I do say wonder goal. You're going to explain to us what he did. Gives Barcelona a 1-0 win over Sevilla. Robbo, maybe it wasn't Barca's best performance of late, and they've had some very good ones, but it's hard not to wax lyrical over
this
kid.
First of all, I don't think it was a bad performance. They created all the chances. They were.
And Sevilla had their opportunities on the break.
Barcelona were much better. This boy is a wonder player, as you just mentioned. I mean, the goal, the ability to change your mind, to change direction, to buy that little bit of space. And
he
then
put
hit with
two guys on their backsides.
Brilliant, absolutely.
Breaking
brilliant.
Ankles, baby. And, yeah. then he, and then that finish. How does he hit it? He's such a little scrawny guy, and he hits it so viciously.
Technique, right contact on the ball, brilliant. He's going to be he's an outstanding player. Now, Manchester United draw with Leicester, 1-1 at home. And they play with Fernandes as the centre forward. What's going on, Gab? How did it work out?
Well, hey, look, I mean, you know, action stations. No Cristiano Ronaldo, no Edinson Cavani, no Mason Greenwood. Marcus Rashford still can't start. And you'd still rather play Bruno Fernandes through the middle. I mean, Alanga and Sancho theoretically wide. Maybe they were supposed to come inside ahead of him. He drops off, he goes forward. And it didn't work. And you know, Leicester up and down. I know Fofana was back. They had the better chances. I thought Leicester could have easily won that game. It goes to show that I think centre forward has to be the number one priority.
Absolutely,
one of those top priorities for United this summer. Real Madrid win 2-1 away at Celta Vigo, but they benefit from not one, not two, but three penalties. They would make two of them, both Karim Benzema, obviously. Some folks are rather cross about it. How did you see it?
Well, I was commentating on the game, and I would have to say the referee got every decision right with the help of VAR.
The Ferland Mendy one as well?
Yes.
You sure about that?
Yeah, I think they're all penalties. I think Ferland Mendy came inside, the defender dangled his leg out, and he's going across him. He's coming into the box to shoot with his right foot. He gets too square, the defender. It's a penalty. They're not bad tackles, but they are penalties. And the disallowed goal, that was also the right decision because Aspas was interfering with the player getting back onto the line.
It was funny. So, with hindsight, if Aspas just stops. Mm. Do you think Alaba clears it?
I think he might have gone on a straighter line to the ball because he had to try and run round Aspas and then miss the ball.
Crazy backspin bounce.
Oh my God. But Aspas was, to a certain degree, he was clever to know that he might have just been a fraction offside and not touched the ball. But what he should have done is get completely out the way. Now, staying with Madrid, your old pal Ancelotti got COVID. So was that his son on the bench?
Yeah, so it was weird. It was his son, David Ancelotti, who was on the bench, but because he doesn't have his pro license, he's not officially the number two, so he wasn't allowed to go and give instructions to the players. Alban Perdomo was the guy who was doing it, but Alban Perdomo isn't really part of Ancelotti's staff. He runs the youth academy, Real Madrid, if I'm not mistaken, and David Ancelotti spent the whole time on the bench on the phone with his dad.
So hang on, so you were on the phone to Carlo. Carlo was then telling David what was going on, and David was then telling the coach what was going on.
Precisely.
So in other words, you were running the
team.
That's
exactly it. I was in charge. Watford gave Liverpool a fight, but Jurgen Klopp's crew nevertheless emerges 2-0 victors. Robbo, they deserved it, but Roy Hodgson will be ruining those missed chances.
Yeah, because Liverpool certainly weren't at their best at the start of the game. Liverpool didn't press the ball particularly well, and Watford played okay on the counter-attack. Kuchka had 1v1, and Hernandez had a couple of chances. So it was
João Pedro as well.
Yeah, João Pedro that just got it over the top of the crossbar or down the side of the post. So, yeah, it'd be ruined. That it was an okay performance by Liverpool. They just about did enough to.
I think
win.
You realize how big Trent Alexander-Arnold's shoes are, yes. And how like Joe Gomez as a centre back. I mean, but he did put
a great ball in for Jota's goal. PSG destroy Lorient 5-1. Mbappe, Neymar, and Messi all start, and they all score. But Mauricio Pochettino was booed by his own fans. Gab, neither of these things are the story, though, at Parc des Princes.
No, remarkably not. The story is the fact that they ask, you know, Kylian Mbappe after the game for the 10 millionth time, are you going to extend your contract at Paris Saint-Germain? And he says, I haven't decided yet, but there are some new elements to be considered. Mm-hmm. Now, everybody's wondering, what are these new factors? Mm-hmm. Real Madrid offering more money?
Yep.
Did Paris Saint-Germain sweeten the deal? Do we know something about what the Qataris are supposed to do after, going to do after the World Cup? Does it have to do with Lionel Messi and those sort of enigmatic words he put out about, you know, reevaluating his future after the World Cup? We don't know. Mm-hmm. So stay tuned. Manchester City score early to dispatch Burnley 2-0. Robbo, it's a lot easier against teams like Burnley when you score early. But I want to ask about that all-English front line of Jack Grealish, Phil Foden, and Raheem Sterling. I thought they looked really good. Mm-hmm. Admittedly, it's easier because it's Burnley and you scored first and whatever. But I'm wondering, is this a plan B in case something happens to Harry Kane at the World Cup? Or is this the kind of thing that really only works if you've got Kevin De Bruyne? And while Kevin De Bruyne is half English, he doesn't play for England.
And you've got to remember, Sterling doesn't often play on the right-hand side, which he did particularly well against Burnley. He created the goal when the ball was played over the top. He laid it back for Kevin De Bruyne. He did it for the second goal. He played a little 1-2 and got the cross in for Gundogan. So he played very well. Grealish, I still don't think's at the sort of performance or level he was at Aston Villa because he doesn't. He's frightened of giving the ball away, so he doesn't run with it as much as he did at Aston Villa. So not quite as threatening. And Foden is playing as the position they call the false number nine, and he's doing it very well. And the answer is no. There's a lot of rotation.
Like, I can't say right now if Harry Kane, something happens with Harry Kane, he's not available or whatever, or he plays badly. I think the England centre. If I were English, I'd want my England centre forward to be Phil Foden. Because you know what? He can drop off and create the way Harry Kane does as well.
Absolutely. Okay. Now, Bayern beat up Freiburg away from home 4-1. But there's two big stories in this one, Gab. Leon Goretzka's return, and he scored a goal. And the little business of the Bavarian playing with 12 men for about 15 seconds.
Yeah, I think it might have been a little more than that. But look, Goretzka is huge. Goretzka and Kimmich is a great midfield. Kimmich and anybody else just doesn't work as well for Bayern. Yeah, they'll still beat you because there's so many great players, but it's a game changer. Mm. It's a game changer for the Champions League as well. This 12 men, they made a substitution. Mm. They put up number 29, which is Kingsley Coman's old number. So he was supposed to come off, but he doesn't wear number 29 anymore. He now wears number 11.
So that must have been the Bayern staff's fault, that they still thought he was number 29.
I think it was Bayern's team manager who made that mistake. Equally, you're the fourth official. You've got the team sheet. Oh, look, you know, there is 29. You know, there is no 29. Come on, man. Mm. Sort it out. There were suggestions that Bochum might protest. As far as I understand the rules, the correct thing is yellow card for not coming off the pitch, and that's it. So I don't think this idea of forfeiting, that would be crazy.
No, not for 12 seconds.
Tottenham Hotspur come from behind to destroy Newcastle 5-1. Robbo, they're joint fourth, at least for a few hours ahead of Arsenal's game tonight. And all right, Harry Kane didn't score, but I thought he was absolutely magnificent. He is a 9 and a 10 rolled into one.
He is
the English Benzema.
I did Benzema at the weekend, and we were talking about how Benzema comes short and dictates the play, but then arrives in the box at the right time. Harry Kane's doing exactly the same. Harry Kane's range of passing is better than Benzema's, but I mean, when he comes short and he starts picking out those passes, particularly for Son, particularly for Kulusevski, but you have to have players that are going to run beyond him. And Kulusevski, you didn't get that much of an opportunity at Juventus. He's showing what a good player he is, and Son is still making those runs at high intensity and still showing the control with his finishes as well.
Harry Kane's second half of the season is something to behold, I think.
And is that because of Antonio Conte getting the best out of him? I know you
maybe
love Antonio
the
Conte.
Contract spill over, whatever.
So it can't be Conte's.
No, maybe it's Conte. I don't know.
Another bad day for Borussia Dortmund at home to Leipzig. They lose 4-1. Season's over for them, isn't it?
Yeah, it's over. Some might say it was been over for a while. Look, and it's a bad season. And they're going to finish second. And it's a bad season because there's been so many low points, losing to Sampaoli in the third round of the Pokal, getting knocked out by Glasgow Rangers, that horrendous champions in the Europa League, the horrendous Champions League performance. But I think this is really a time to, and I know they've got more points than last year, sit back and reflect. Because what cannot happen, what must not happen at this club is that, like, aha, it's Marco Rose's fault. It's Marco Rose's fault that we defend horrendously. And this happened again in this game. They had a decent first 20 minutes where they had a lot of possession, maybe not that much cutting.
Lima scored, I think, with their first shot, didn't he, for Leipzig, I think?
Yeah, because guess what? It's Keystone Cops defending. Mm. Everybody goes up and you leave, you know, he switched to a back three. You leave them with Witzel exposed. None of them are particularly quick except for Akanji. There's no cover. People come from all positions, move the ball around, and they shoot on goal time and time again. Is that Marco Rose's fault? Yeah, I think it's partly Marco Rose's fault. But you cannot say, oh, let's replace Marco Rose with somebody else and we'll be fine. You cannot do that. You have to look at yourself. Kale, Zorc, all these people, Vatske. Mm. Oh, we're the smartest time in the world. Yeah, look at all these great young players we have. Well, guess what? It's not working. You're underachieving.
You're not winning
letting
titles.
Robbo.
81,000 were at the
81,000! This was the first time it was a full house since pre-pandemic. And you put in this kind of performance. They need to think about it. I think Erling Haaland, 99.9%, is going to be gone. So think about, oh, look, that 75 million euros that we're getting from him. How are we going to spend it? How can we spend it in a smart way? Let's have a think about who our manager is going to be. If it's Rose again, what's going to help him? Stop getting like a bunch of guys who are similar to other guys who play similar positions. Take a look at your medical department because all the injuries you had, that was pretty ridiculous. And ask yourself, if we don't play to our level, are we just going to end up losing people like Bellingham, like Gio Reyna when he comes back and plays consistently? Are we just going to keep losing these people? You know, already Moukoko has got one foot out the door. I mean, he was supposed to be your future, right? Still very young.
So a massive club, not very well run at the moment.
They're horrendously run, in my opinion. Atletico Madrid beat Alaves 4-1, and João Félix steals the show. Robbo, he now has 6 goals in his last 6 Liga games. Atleti started a little bit in this game. You know, it was 1-1 with 30 minutes to go. Then he makes a substitution. Luis Suarez as well. Shout out to Pistolero, 2 goals. Like, but I want to ask you specifically about João Félix. So they may have overpaid for him, I think they definitely overpaid for him. But he's still just 22 years old.
Yeah.
What's his ceiling?
He can be a top 10 player, in my view. He's got all the attributes. He can run with the ball. He can score goals. He can pick out passes. But they've got to play him consistently. They've got to find a position for him. He's playing up front at the moment alongside Griezmann. I'm not sure that's going to be his best position in years to come. I would have thought he'd have been a player that would come off the left-hand side in maybe a front three and play 1-2s and that sort of stuff. But he can be a top-class player. There's no question about that. Big win for Napoli, who beat Atalanta 3-1 away at the weekend, but no Osimhen.
Yeah, but they're still in the running. They got the win. No Osimhen, no Rahmani, who's been so good for them at the back. No Di Lorenzo, that's half their starting back four out. They're playing, you know, Atalanta, who have shown that, you know, they can
on their day,
wicked black and blue. Yeah, and I thought Atalanta certainly had the upper hand until the penalty put Napoli ahead. Then they added a second, and they kind of saw the game out. I think it's kind of what you need to do when you've got big players missing
out. Can Spalletti win the title?
I think he can. I think he can. You know, he said afterwards, you know, well, we got to make this count. You know, I'm not getting another chance to win the title after this season. Like, I'm pretty sure of that. Most of these guys won't either. You know, like, wow.
Way to he's be not staying then. There, he's not staying.
But no, they're in the running, and why not? Milan play this evening. We'll as we record this, we'll see how that goes. But yeah, no, it's a legit three-way race. Leeds United draw 1-1 with Southampton, but Robbo, Jesse Marsh was very annoyed when his assistant substituted on the wrong player. I thought this was kind of funny.
Well, I'll keep it short. Luke Ayling, the right back, went down injured and didn't look as though he was going to come back on or get up. So they called the substitute down, a striker, I think it is. And
Goodridge or something like that.
Yeah, and then he gets up and runs on and he's okay. So they then changed their mind because Liam Cooper, who's come back after a long-term injury and was starting to look as though he was struggling. So Jesse Marsh wanted to make that substitution, bring on a centre-half for Liam Cooper. But the assistant didn't get it right and gave the fourth official, Luke Ayling, who then came off. Much to Jesse Marsh's annoyance.
It was funny because I don't know Jesse Marsh personally, but I know of him. I know he's one of those Princeton guys, which kind of skews me. But I also know, he's a good manager. He showed it before. And he comes across as one of those clean-cut, nice Midwestern guys. I think he's from Wisconsin or something like that. And yet, He was angry, so much so that if you watched a video of him, they had to do that thing where they kind of pixelate his mouth in case some lip reader is offended by his use of industrial language. The human side of Jesse Marsh, but he's going to keep Leeds up, right?
I think so, yes. Yeah. I think they're just about good enough, and he's about good enough. Now, Roma are up to fifth in Serie A after beating Sampdoria 1-0. Gab, I presume that Mourinho's now sort of just got a smile on his face?
I think so, because, you know, fifth is one spot higher than sixth where they were last year. And Mourinho critics will point out that they outspent everybody else in Serie A, and they're spending a ton of money on Mourinho. And obviously, if I change managers, I expect you to do better. I think they played reasonably well. They could have scored more. Sampdoria are, I think, officially terrible. But, you know, you can only beat what's in front of you.
Yeah.
Tammy Abraham, not the best game. Missed a couple chances. Big goal from Mkhitaryan. Yeah, I think fifth or sixth, I think, is where Roma are going to end up. And
is that good enough?
I mean, a jump into the top four would have been difficult because other teams have improved a lot this summer. But I don't know. I don't know if they can sustain.
He'll be there next year, yes?
Oh, yeah, he'll definitely be back next year. He's got a contract.
Yeah.
Back to Leeds, where James Ward-Prowse scored his 13th free-kick goal for Southampton. Robbo, in the Premier League era, only David Beckham, with 18, has scored more. You used to teach people how to play football, literally. Mm. Now, I want to ask you, are free kicks something that can be taught, something that can be perfected? Because I'm incomplete, because anecdotally, I hear so many stories of Juninho Pernambucano go out there, like, taking, like, 500 free kicks after practice and putting them all. Mm. It doesn't seem that hard if you practice long enough, right?
Well, each player has his own technique. You can teach, as a coach, you can teach the basic technique. This is how you kick the ball, and this is what you want to try and do, and this is what you're trying to achieve. But the very top free kick takers, and James Ward-Prowse is definitely one of those, has perfected his own technique. He comes from a very wide position on the ball. He plays it almost with the inside of his foot, you can see his foot actually roll up the ball as he makes the strike. And there's been all different ways of doing it. Ronaldo had a different way. You talked about Juninho doing it in a different way. There's lots of players that do it. Gareth Bale we saw for Wales. Not for Real Madrid, for Wales against Austria. So I think he's taught himself, and now he's the best in the business at doing it. Absolutely.
Okay. If you had a young kid, like, I always wonder about this, because even the best free kick trickers, they'll only score two or three a season, right? Given that it's something that you can genuinely replicate, given that, you know, there's a zone of free kicks, you might not get that many a game, but you normally will get a couple chances from there. Would there be a benefit in just locking somebody on a training pitch with a bunch of dummies and a goalkeeper for hours afterwards and saying, this automatic?
As long as they didn't sort of pull their thigh muscle from over-kicking, because, again, it's a technique we have to hit the ball fairly hard. So you can only do so much of that after a training session. But, yes. But I think it almost comes to a player that they've got that special ability, and they realise that and think, this is something I can build my name on.
So it's more nature than nurture.
Yeah, and then they build it up after a while, and they carry on doing it and carry on doing it. But something they pick up that other players can't do. Now, Gab, you just got back from Doha, where you went to the World Cup draw, and am I right in thinking that the migrant workers' rights and LGBTQ issues are the biggest talking points off the pitch or not?
I think they are. I mean, they're the ones that obviously people have the most concern about. We saw at the World Cup draw the president of the Norwegian FA asking for time on the floor and addressing the issue of migrant workers' rights, recognizing that a lot's been done, but it's important that the pressure stay on. Like, my personal view is the situation in Qatar is not dissimilar to other countries in the Gulf, with the difference being that they've passed new legislation. They've eliminated the kafala system, which was considered by many, you know, tantamount almost to slavery, because you have to kind of pay ahead of time an agency to get there, and then you can't switch jobs once you're there, and that puts you in a weaker position. So that's been eliminated. There are workers who are switching jobs, which is, you know, a big step forward. I mean, you talk to expats, for example, in this country, including people you know, you get a visa, an employment visa in this country, you can't change jobs. You got to leave the country and then get a new one, right? I mean, so we can't get too high and mighty about this, I think, in the West. The reality is, if you're a migrant worker on an employment visa, there you've got a ton of restrictions. The working conditions, I think, is the other big one. They've worked with trade unions. The feedback is that the situation has improved. They say it's up to Western standards. I don't know. I'm not an expert in this. But I think what's absolutely critical is that you can't just kind of improve things for a couple of years ahead of the World Cup. There has to be a will to enforce the laws. It's great to write the laws. You have to have people who are willing to enforce the laws, to reach out, to make sure that the workers are protected, as that they have those rights that are granted them by the law, and to make sure it continues afterwards. As for LGBTQ issues, it's a big issue. Again, the Qataris say that everybody is welcome. They do say that public displays of affection, regardless of whether it's an LGBTQ display of affection or it's you know, a man and a woman, those are frowned upon. It's not part of their culture.
Mm.
But, you know, we'll see how this goes. I think it's critical that everybody be respectful when they go. And it's also critical that everybody be made to feel welcome. Mm. And I think the Qatari authorities, you know, they have to ensure that nobody who goes out there who just wants to watch a football match feels unsafe or threatened in any way, just for who they are and just for being themselves. Mo Salah is reportedly close to agreeing a new deal with Liverpool. Robbo, we don't know the numbers yet, but Sadio Mane and Roberto Firmino are also out of contract in 2023. Mm-hmm. It's the big trifecta. Please rank them by priority as you see it.
Mo Salah is the most important player, that's for sure. I mean, he's still...
Is that just because he's better than the other two?
He's better than the other two. Then you'd go to Mane, who I still think is an outstanding player. He'll score goals. And when Salah's not playing well, he comes to the fore that little bit more, and he's part of the style of play that Klopp wants to use, that quick counter-attacking style of play. The ball's over the top as well. So Mane would be second. And Firmino, unfortunately, I think he's drifting away from being an important player at Liverpool.
It's interesting. I was just curious. The reason I put this like this is I can rank them. Most people would have them ranked the same way. It's just that I wonder if Firmino's skill set is so unique that in some ways, you know, he gives you something different. It is that type of player is more difficult to replace. You know, Mane's fantastic, but if Mane's not there, or even Salah, you know, Luis Diaz can do many of the same things. Jota can do many of the same things. Maybe not as well or as consistently.
So what would you say Firmino's different skill sets are?
I think the ability to drop into space and link play.
Could Diaz do that?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I don't think that's
it. Can Jota do that? He did it for Portugal when Ronaldo was playing up front against North Macedonia.
Jota perhaps more so. I don't think Jota has Firmino's awareness or range of passing. Firmino, when fully fit, is also really effective off the ball.
Yeah.
He's a pressing machine.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a very efficient presser of the ball. By the time Jota puts in a ton of effort too.
Could you replace him with somebody, not in the squad at the moment, but with somebody else? I'm not sure you'd be able to replace Salah and Mane, would you, with the same quality?
Not with the same quality, but you can get similar type of... In fact, you could argue that maybe Diaz and Jota are the replacements already there. I don't know. It's an interesting one. I say, look, I've said this many times. I don't think, as great as these guys are, none of them deserve to be kept at any price.
No.
There's a right price at which you keep them.
Always.
I think well done Liverpool.
Because we've seen Aubameyang, who was the key player at Arsenal, and they had to keep at all costs.
Yeah, we saw how well that worked out.
Yeah. Now, Levante have just had just 8 points in the first half of the season and only won their first league game in December. But they beat Villarreal at the weekend, which means they're no longer bottom. Can they stay up?
They have 14 points in 11 games since the halfway mark, which you can say, you know, that's not a big deal. But what? That's
a big deal for a team that were right at the bottom, yeah.
I think they're still 6 points from relegation, but they have a little bit of momentum. They have an Italian manager, which I think I cover football for a living, I'd never heard of before this season, who's come on.
Yeah.
Alessio Lisci is his name, although in Spain they probably call him Lisci. I think it's a phenomenal... They have El Comandante Morales, which I love. I think it's a phenomenal story that... I mean, this would be one of the greatest escapes. This is something we're going to talk about for a long
time.
They're
not going to do it, are they?
I don't know. They got the run. Villarreal, a good side. At the request of coaches, FIFA are considering allowing 26-man squads at the World Cup, like we had at the Euros. But some coaches aren't in favour, Robbo. Can you work out why?
The only reason I think they wouldn't want that many players is because they've got to try and now keep 26 players happy. There'd be a them and us situation with the squad that's picked for the games and the players that aren't picked.
Also a proposal to have them all on the bench, have them all
available. Yeah, but how do you keep... Some of those players, they're not part of the team. They're not going to be getting on the pitch. How do you keep them fit you know, when without, because you're not going to play too many games, you're going to have to practice games. When you play, if you, everybody's fit and you play practice games, there's still going to be a couple of players on the side of the pitch doing nothing. That's the only reason I can think you wouldn't want a bigger squad, because you'd want more to pick from, so, I would say.
I spoke to one of the World Cup managers when I was in Doha, and he said the reason people are against it is because, as the rules stand, you can still only name 20. It was like at the Euros, you know, you can only name 23 players for your matchday squad.
So three were left.
And they hated telling the three guys who were sitting out.
So they're going to be unhappy. They're going to be miserable. They're going to be hard to motivate.
Okay, can I say something? Look, you were in dressing rooms and stuff, both as a player and as a coach. I wasn't. Equally, if you're number 24, 25, and 26 on the team, are you happier being there or just sitting at home watching on television? I mean, at some point, part of your job as a manager is to go and tell people they're not starting, dropping people. And frankly, I kind of feel if you're a national team manager and you can't go to your, because one of those guys may well probably be a keeper, I assume. You can't go to your number 24th, 25th best player and say, dude, you weren't going to play anyway because I wasn't starting you. You're not going to have your ass
parked
on the bench. You're going to be in the stands for this game. I forget, oh, no, I can't do it. It's too painful. But oh, he's going to make those
all
sad
these
eyes.
Managers, when you look at, listen to these managers talking, Gareth Southgate being one, it's all about the team spirit, the love for everybody. They all got to feel part of it. If you've got three players that aren't involved in the squad, that's I'm not agreeing with what they're saying.
Oh, no,
saying,
I'm sure you were pretty hard. You probably even relished.
You're not good enough,
people.
You're out,
Well, because in your day, you had two substitutes, only two people on the bench, right?
Yeah.
When you started?
When I started, just one.
Yeah, so, was that a problem back then?
No.
Oi, Bob, you're not coming to our away game against Darlington this weekend. Why did Bob
take it? If you weren't in the 12, you played in the reserves. You played on exactly the same time on a Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock, so it was slightly different. Right. Now, Lionel Messi has signed a reported $20 million deal to become global brand ambassador for Socios. Does it make sense to you, Gab?
So Socios, we've talked about this before, they're fan tokens, they're NFTs, non-fungible tokens. You buy them for not much money, and then they give you access to fan experiences and prizes and so on. They're spending an enormous amount of money in the game, and this is making some people a little bit uneasy. I think a lot of us in our reporting, because we go and we confuse this with crypto, which many people don't understand, and you know that some people made a lot of money and lost a lot of money on it, so it feels a bit skeevy to them. I think there are legit questions to ask of Socios, which also has to do with, without getting too technical, that their tokens are backed by a cryptocurrency, which is also owned by Socios. So you have some question, is this maybe something speculative? I just think if you're Messi, yeah, $20 million is a lot of money. You have a lot of money.
Do you want to get involved?
I don't
in that?
Know that you necessarily want to get, because there could be a backlash to this. I don't think the world is quite ready to it. We've already seen a backlash to this. I mean, Liverpool, the take up of their NFT program, that's had a kind of big backlash. Arsenal are also Socios' team. A lot of Arsenal supporters are like, what the hell is this? I mean, you know, you're not paying very much money. You know, I think it's €2, I think, in most of these clubs to buy a fan token. But equally, I don't know, it hasn't had the best press. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure Messi did it because he genuinely believes in blockchain technology and whatnot, and not because they gave him $20 million. Ralf Rangnick has said that Manchester United board must let the next permanent manager rip up the squad in the summer if they want to challenge Manchester City and Liverpool. Thank you, Captain Obvious. He also said, which I thought was more interesting, that his United players lack a certain kind of physicality and aggression, and that, you know, you can take a very skillful player, but you can't make him be aggressive and physical if it's not part of his DNA. I have two questions for you on this, because I thought this was really interesting. Okay, I'm not going to ask you who he's talking about, because I think, you know, we're going to speculate. Assume it's Marcus Rashford, right? But the other thing is, there's ways to win games without being physical and aggressive, right? That's just how Rangnick won games, and he became a great manager because of it. So if you don't have a squad filled with those types of players, why are you hiring a manager that demands that?
Well, absolutely right. There's two ways when a new manager comes in or a manager takes over. He either says, I'm going to do it my way and I've got to get the players to buy into it, which you can't always do, as he's now saying. Well, actually, the players aren't physically fit enough or strong enough.
I'm sure he knew that when he took over.
Yeah, exactly. So he's got to come up with something different. Or you take over a club and look at the players who you have available and say, what style of play will suit the players until I can get the players in that I want? So I think he's probably gone about it the wrong way, and he's now probably upset most of the squad by saying the players need to be ousted and the new manager coming in has got to get rid of most of the players. I don't think he's done himself any favours there.
No, I mean, look, he doesn't name names, right? But I would assume that...
By not naming names, everybody can think they're part of it.
Based on his track record and the players he's had success with and the players that Leipzig bought, he favours young, fast, aggressive players, right? Those are the guys he generally had. That would rule out Cristiano Ronaldo. Mm. That would rule out Cavani.
Fernandes?
Bruno Fernandes, definitely.
Yeah.
Rashford, you know, maybe on the aggression side. I'm assuming he puts Rashford with him because he doesn't play the guy, even when everybody's out. I don't know that it's helpful to come out and say that,
no,
but the way I read it, though, is, Ralph, you're speaking the truth. You know, this is what I do as a manager. You knew that. To me, this is another indictment of the club's recruitment policy.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, I don't know how big a role Mertz and Fletcher played in bringing him in. You know, I've always defended them. They've only been in the job a year. Let's see what they do. But if it was their decision to bring him in, you either commit to him and keep him around next season, or it's not somebody who you have as an interim manager because you can tell that what he wants is completely different from the players you have.
But I imagine when he was interviewed for taking the job, they'd have said to him, what style of football, do you think you can get your style of football out of these players? And I bet he said, yes, I can. I will make them faster. I'll make them stronger. I'll make them more aggressive. I'll make them a better team. They're going to be pressing the ball. The crowd are going to love it. We're going to play attacking football. And he hasn't been able to do it.
Yeah, because when you go to a job interview, you say, hey, can you do the job? You would say, no, I can't.
You would say, well, but you need a lot of new players. And you have to be honest at times, not just take the job and then moan about it afterwards. Now, Dynamo Kiev will play a series of friendlies against Barcelona, PSG and Milan to help raise funds for Ukraine. Gab, football is coming together, isn't it?
Yeah, I think this is a great initiative. It's obviously, it's not just about raising funds. It's about raising awareness as well. I'd love to see other football clubs do it. I don't quite know the dynamic because surely there's some footballers who, you know, because of the war, who happen to be Ukrainian, have maybe been pressed into military duty or aren't able to do it. But I think it's critical that those who are free to do it, I don't even know where they are. I should find out that they have the opportunity to train the ones who aren't on the home front defending their country, that they have the opportunity to train, the opportunity to raise awareness for this. And this is another way that football can support them. And well done, PSG, Milan, and Barcelona.
Yeah.
To be honest, if whatever team I supported, I don't care if it's Zorya Luhansk or some no-name team, you know, I would buy a ticket to go watch them against my team just to go and support this effort because there's a massive humanitarian crisis there. Holland boss Louis van Gaal has revealed that he is battling prostate cancer and until recently kept it from his players. Robbo, our thoughts are with him.
Absolutely. Let's hope that he does recover. I know lots of people that have had prostate cancer and recovered and been fine afterwards. He's a great coach. Let's hope it all works out for him.
Wasn't at the World Cup draw in Doha, I think partly because of it.
Now, here's one for you. Jack Grealish is on the verge of signing a seven-figure deal with Gucci. You've got a contract with Armani, is that true?
Yes, as you can tell, copious amounts of Armani. No, my style leans differently.
More casual?
More Carhartt, I would say.
Okay.
That kind of stuff. But no, look, I don't know. I'm not an expert in luxury goods. I'm not a fan of the Gucci brand, although I'm a big fan of Gaga. And in fact, I watched
the film, not a good film.
Yeah, I thought the film was okay.
I watched it on my way to Doha.
But yeah, to me, I know it's an Italian brand or used to be an Italian brand. It's always a little Gucci's a little bit cheesy.
It is.
A little bit nouveau for my taste. Mm. But anyway, that brings us to an end. Thank you so much for filling
always
in
a
for
pleasure.
Jules. But he's going to be back on Thursday to the delight of the millions and millions of Julian Lawrence fans out there. Until then, love the game, love your neighbor, love yourself.